What you keep as part of your memory is not a choice, according to a blurb on the back of Keep, the new book by poet Deborah Poe. Michael Ruby says, each person's memory is a vast, mostly unconscious construction that can provide the materials for conscious construction. And I would add, is shaped by neurobiology and personal mythology, or the other way around. Regardless, the spot where the brain science meets Dogen's Buddhism and manifests in memory is at the core of Deborah Poe's poetry in this book, and it has a depth and a richness that rewards repeated readings. Deborah is our guest today to talk about Keep, about her work, and about the territory she covers here. So delighted to have you here in this setting and talking about your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
I'm happy to be here.
This moment here was a long time in manifesting.
I know.
Yes, I got that.
I know.
What was the name of that conference in Binghamton, New York? Writing by Degrees.
Yeah, Writing by Degrees.
That's right. And your involvement in that, you helped?
I was a co-director.
Co-director,
of the conference. Every year it was directed by graduate students who basically drove all the organization of the conference with support but very little assistance, you know, just broader support from the faculty. So it really was a graduate student-led effort. Supported by the department, and I co-directed it that year.
Yeah,
I believe
you were a graduate student.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I did my PhD at Binghamton.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Who'd you study with?
I studied, well, to be honest, I studied fiction, because the poetry. There were a few reasons. One is that I had gotten done with my master's at Western Washington, and it was really focused on poetry. I wrote a poetry manuscript, which was Our Parenthetical Ontology, my first book, published later. But I also wanted to explore fiction as another means of expression, and in addition, it was a better fit for me in what I was doing. I was looking at global literature. I was trying to get global literature in the mix, and literary theory and fiction lent itself much more easily to the work that I wanted to do with those. Also the aesthetics of the poetry department were about as categorically oppositional as you could get. Maria Mazzioti Gillen is a profoundly narrative poet. That's how she comes to the page. I do not. I don't come in a straight line, but we can talk about that more if you'd like.
And we could talk about global literature. I mean, who are some examples of folks that you admire?
I love Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I love Juno Diaz. I love Arundhati Roy. Her novel, The God of Small Things, is one of my favorite novels. And in fact, I ended up, when I got to my job at Pace University after I finished my PhD at Binghamton, I ended up co-editing an anthology of, and it was an anthology of criticism and fiction, and included many of the authors that I just cited, and many of my favorites.
Of course, that's how it's done.
Yeah.
How did you first get the idea to write Keep?
That is a very good question. Let me think about this. I got it in my head that I wanted to look at the relationship between brain science and psychology, Buddhist philosophy, and look at those together as a way to consider memory. And I wanted to, I think memory is super important. Oh, you know what, even more importantly though, was that I recognized in myself this inability to really have set memories. Like, some people can just say, oh, there was the time when I was 12 and I did this, this, and this, and they remember so many details. I am not that person. Mm-hmm. I have much more of an emotional summary memory. And I started calling my memories scattered thunderstorms, because it was like these little fragments. And so the very first, the essence of the book at first was just looking at those scattered thunderstorms, those fragments of memory, and then seeing what happened from those. And then the book went from there. So what happened is that I ended up building a lens, so to speak, of psychology, neuroscience, and Buddhist philosophy, and then poems that were about those scattered thunderstorms that were really place specific in addition. That's how it ended up. And like looking at those through this lens that I built in at first. So
The poems do read as if someone did a mashup of neuroscience and Buddhism, but it's at a very high level. I mean, I understand Buddhism a little bit and neuroscience certainly less than that, but it seems to me a really high level. What do you have a background in these things?
I have a background in writing about science. So it's not for whatever reason. I am a very creative person, but I'm also a very analytical person. And that is why I ended up at Microsoft. That is why I also ended up as a professor. And that is why, you know, I have ended up in these varying careers and whatnot, because I just really always want to feed those two parts of myself. And so in my writing, that has led me to be very interested in writing about science and, you know, translating scientific terms or ideas into layperson's terms and really exploring that. It's like, I love to research. I'm definitely a very research intensive poet. My novella in verse, which is a full length collection, lineated like poetry, called Alain, is it had an inordinate amount of research about Chinese and French silk production in the 19th century. I even went to France to research. So these things that need to be figured out, like puzzles and researched, are really, like, you know, very attractive to me. And so I had also done a tremendous amount of reading on Buddhism since I, you know, was 19, and was reading a lot about science. And it's also, you know, I should say that it's not always me trying to educate the public about the science. It's sometimes almost like I'm developing a taxonomy from the language, because I do get caught up in the language, but I hope not at the expense of some meaning and emotional resonance.
Right. Edward S. Casey is a prime source for the book. Who is he, and what is it that you find useful about his work?
He is a philosopher who's written a lot about place, and he has written in this kind of multidimensional way. I mean, I don't know if multidimensional is the right word, but he's written about place and memory in a way that's interdisciplinary. That would probably be more apt. And that was very attractive to me. And I have not read many writers that like made sense on this sort of interdisciplinary level the way that he did to me. And he became just like somebody that I did not a deep dive, I wouldn't say, but definitely like explored quite significantly for this book, because I was really compelled, and it felt like he was giving me point of departure after point of departure to consider. And in fact, I'm fairly confident that he is one of the primary reasons that I ended up doing the section on prowns, which is really a meditation on place and memory.
Huh. That's fascinating, the threads and how they come together, and the really esoteric nature of what's influencing is fascinating. And Code might be a good poem to start with, so folks can get a sense of your work.
Okay.
I have the bookmark in my version of the book, or you can simply go to your version, to page 21.
Okay.
And go from there. Talking with Deborah Poe about the book Keep.
Do you want to read it with me?
Sure.
Do you want to read the... So I really view ENCODE, storage, and retrieval as polyvocal pieces, if you will. I imagine them in, there are lines that are in regular text, normal text, and then there are lines that are in italics. Mm-hmm. And I really hear those in a very multiple voice kind of way, mm-hmm. a multivocal way. And so I can read the regular and you, or actually you read the regular and I'll read the italics.
Right,
and
so you know when to come in and do the choral aspect.
Yeah.
Of it. Okay.
And I'll say the title and then you can get started and then we'll just go from there. ENCODE.
Senses first.
Hundreds of flesh blossoms, fragrance, spring curled around blue sky.
Hippocampus and frontal cortex
beings
analyze sensory
bridge distance
inputs.
Between bodies and tree. Same speed, still.
Long-term memory.
Cherry
worth.
Blossoms bloom beyond change.
Bits stored in brain parts.
Clap of thunder, waters meander.
Message leaps and connects across gaps between nerve cells at synapse.
Windflower rain.
Dendrites, feathery tips of brain cells, extend to neighboring cells.
One blossom bears many blossoms.
Electrical firing releases neurotransmitters.
Lightning against fence posts.
Diffuse across spaces between cells.
Inflorescence snow over earth, beneath trees, mind ground.
As changes occur at synapses and dendrites, connections materialize.
Outside in.
First you pay attention.
Mountains, river, and earth.
Much is filtered out.
Thorn bushes.
How you pay attention determines what you remember.
The old branches which do not reach.
Huh. There's so much that goes on in this. And I just came across from a friend in my spiritual community this notion of, is it telomeres, these caps, these shoelace-like caps on synapses or something?
Oh,
like,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
You know about
yes.
this.
Yes, and the brain science has proven that the meditation will it extend those telomeres.
Yeah.
And yes, I mean, meditate, that's why they can show the graphs now of how meditation, because we have such a negativity bias as human beings, and meditation helps you to get around it, among many other things.
Yeah. The line, how you pay attention determines what you remember, is telling, and it seems to me at the core of the content here. How you pay attention determines what you remember. Can you talk about that line?
Sure. Let me think for a moment. Well, I do have a long-standing meditation practice. I view myself as a mindfulness practitioner. And so, to me, how you pay attention speaks to that, of course, which speaks to the integration of Buddhism and brain science in the book. But I also think it's attributing it's interesting what this was happening to me, because, you know, I wrote this however many years ago, and it's actually now I'm seeing it attributing control, like as if you can control mm-hmm. how you remember, mm-hmm. but that's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. I don't think I mean that. I don't think I mean how you pay attention, like you have control over it. I feel like instead I am saying, like, that mindfulness, how you pay attention to the world around you. And I didn't have that in my palette, in my toolbox, so to speak, when I was young. Uh-huh. Would have been really helpful, mind you, but
yeah, well, those things happen for a reason,
right?
Yeah, I'm reminded of Jane Hirschfeld's Buddhism in Seven Syllables, I think it's called. Everything changes, everything's connected, pay attention.
Right. Exactly. Right. That's well said.
You know, when you read at Margin Shift and you had a person from the audience play my role in that case, or I play the role of the person in the audience today, you said, and we talked after the reading about this choral poetry and about, you know, lines kind of running into one another,
mm-hmm.
and you say, this is how my brain works.
Yes.
Yeah. And as a person who studied neuroscience, you'd probably know what you're talking about.
Maybe.
What do you mean by that? I mean, you know, we know about this concept of selves, how we all have, we're all a conglomeration of many different selves, and are several of them coming up when you're in the act of poetry? Is that how it works?
I'm going to make a wild hypothesis, perhaps, but I've been thinking a lot lately, the last month, about the trauma or suffering or struggle, if you will, of certain, you know, events or states across my younger years, let's say. And I'm just turned 50 and I'm still trying to figure it out, and I will probably be, you know, thinking about it for a long time. But anyway, my point being that I've realized that my problem solving nature, my analytical problem solving managerial nature could be seen as a sort of way of being attached in the sensual world. And what I mean by that is that there are selves of mine that have things to tell me in dreams, in images, in like not necessarily language. And I've got those in there and they want to tell me things, and I haven't always been a good listener to those parts of myself. And so I think that I always have this sort of sensual infrastructure. That's what I coined that phrase in my first book. I have this sort of sensual logic that's happening, but I also have this analytical problem-solving nature. And so I do think that both of those things happen, and I think they tangle on the page, and I think they tangle within myself and my person, and I think that just comes through in the poetry, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You know, when I started reading Jose Coser, he has a lot of parenthetical thoughts. And when I started reading about the neo-baroque movement in Latin American poetry and Jose Lezama Lima and others associated with that, many who we published in an mm-hmm. anthology, mm-hmm. Make It True Meets Medusario, I talked to Coser about those. And you know, the neo-baroque featuring parataxis, featuring abrupt subject changes, featuring a lot of parenthetical thoughts, sidebars, and you know, the kind of writing that I think both you and I are very much interested mm-hmm. in. And it seems to me, and in an effort to assimilate or become more familiar with Coser's work, I started writing cover versions of his mm-hmm. poems, right? And it seems to me that writing that way, that in that neo-baroque way, where you're not so much concerned about whatever meaning's coming out, is really how the mind works.
Right.
You know, with these messages, these abrupt subject changes. You look at the way we talk, and if you look at the transcription of this encounter that you and I are having, there could be some gaps. But because we're here together and we have eye contact and we are expressing things, you know, with physiology, that's adding to the ability for the meaning to get across, whereas you don't have that on the page. So there are some gaps, which I think in poetry are things I like. Perhaps mm-hmm. that's the reason you didn't study poetry at Binghamton, because the people you would have studied with are saying, you got to get this out. They would have workshopped
right.
a lot of the weirdness out. So it seems to me that writing in the way that you're writing, or the way that Coser's writing, or the way that Bernadette Mayer's writing, or many other people that I think we both like, is a more true transcription or act of how someone's mind really
yeah,
works.
The non-linearity of thought. Yeah. Yeah.
Dogen is a person who comes up in the book, and Norman Fisher is another mm-hmm. source that comes up in the book, and this goes to the Buddhist side of you. So maybe you can talk about where you first encountered these writers and what you've gleaned from them.
Okay. So Dogen came up for me when I started sitting with a Soto Zen sangha in New York, in upstate New York, in the Hudson Valley. And I had sat with a Soto Zen group in Bellingham, Tim Burnett, and Red Cedar Zen is the group specifically. And if we explored Dogen, I don't remember Dogen, although he's very instrumental or important for the Soto Zen lineage.
He started it, didn't
yes,
he not? Yeah.
Yes. And so, I might have been introduced to him earlier and I don't remember, but I had never read him. For whatever reason, when I first started sitting at Twining Vines, which was in New York.
Yeah.
She was reading a lot, the teacher was reading a lot from Dogen, and it was just like hitting me like exactly like it was just, you know, excuse me, like a metaphysical precision collision, if you will. Like I was like, it was really meaningful and resonant. And so that started, you know, an interest in Dogen, and I ended up getting, you know, The Moon in a Dewdrop and like two books of Kaz's translations of his work, and just loving them so much. You know, I would say probably nearly as much as I loved the Tao Te Ching when I was 19 and I picked it up and went, oh my God, what is this? But for some reason I hadn't read Dogen, and I had read probably a lot more Chinese thinkers in translation, frankly. But so that, and then Norman was connected to Red Cedar Zen because he's up frequently in Seattle and in Bellingham. And so I was introduced to him, and honestly, I don't know if I knew he was a poet until I moved to New York. And then when I moved to New York, I realized that he was a poet and a Buddhist. And, you know, so, and that the book, the Blown Back book, is really very, it was just, it felt very related. It felt like a cousin, at least, to this book. I really appreciate Norman's philosophical meditations, and I've always been interested in theology and spirituality, and I think that he is very interested in that too, and kind of what, so that's another kind of connection. I don't know if that's answered your question, but
yeah. We touched on this earlier, and the question I had lined up next to go was, do you find that Buddhists from centuries ago are having their cosmologies verified by cutting-edge science? And you already testified to that.
Oh, I remember when I started deeply studying literary theory, Derrida and other, you know, post-structuralism. I did a whole field exam on post-structuralism and language theory. I was amazed. I was like, these guys are, you know, European thinkers. And this was like stuff that the Chinese and Japanese thinkers were writing about
1200 years ago.
Precisely. Is this mine?
No, but I can pour you more tea.
Okay, here, great. Thank you.
Let me do that. You know, the interesting thing is that though correct me if I'm wrong, because you've studied more than I do, and I can only kind of sniff around it and give you the intuitive hit, but the deconstructionists, for them, it's the same notion as...
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's the same notion as Buddhism I'm not sure exactly how to articulate this, but their conclusion is nihilism, whereas the Buddhist conclusion is you've got to meditate and do your work,
right?
Which is life-giving.
Right.
So the deconstructionists go through, they come to the same conclusion as the Buddhists, except their action is to jump out of the fucking building or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I hate to put it that way, because that's not a very Buddhist or kind thing to say, but it seems to me, like you said, they're talking about things that's 1,200 years old, so you might as well go to Dogen.
Right. Yeah.
All right, I said that, you didn't.
Yeah.
So I'm on the record for that. But a lot, you know, the telomeres and other things are being verified by science, as you know. You're you know, 1,000 times more of a scientist than I am, but they're validating.
I don't think so. I don't.
They're validating what you're talking about. They're validating Buddhism, and they're validating your own practice.
Right.
The sciences.
Right, right. And I think another important part of this that I just thought of is that there is probably nothing that I'm more oppositional to than a binary way of being. And so that is why post-structuralism, that is why Dogen, that is why the Tao Te Ching are attractive to me, because, and I know that that is at least partly from my upbringing. I was a military brat. I experienced, you know, I had to move a lot, and it was not always easy. I wasn't always like just easily belonging anywhere, and that made me very sensitive to questions of difference. And I think that, among other reasons, makes me very, you know, Like, I think that there is a defiance in this whole, like, leaving academe thing that I said, no, you can't do that. Nobody leaves a tenure track job. But I did, because I'm not going to be stuck in a silo. I'm not going to be stuck in a box. I don't want to be put in a box. I don't want to be labeled. I don't like binary ways of being or thinking. And so I think that's in there as well. Right, probably related to all of the last two or three questions that you've asked me, and so I thought it worth noting.
Yeah, absolutely. There are at least a couple of musical references in the book, Lady Sings the Blues, mm-hmm. My Funny Valentine. Can you talk about the connection between music and memory? It's the funniest thing, where we'll be in conversation with my partner or my daughter, and some phrase will come up, and I either think of a song lyric or a line of poetry or a joke. They prefer if it's a song lyric or poetry, usually, to the jokes, because I have a lot of dad jokes. But music and memory.
Yeah, so music is hugely important to me. I played piano for 9 years, from, you know, whatever age to high school, my junior year. I love music. I listen to music a lot. It's a very important part of the fabric of my life, and I wake up with songs, and they're sometimes very important because they're the gateways into the dream space that I just left. And Lady Sings the Blues, well, that poem, Lady Sing the Blues, is a reference to an ex of mine named Paul Dees. He is no longer living. He died of AIDS. And I hated Valentine's Day. And this was in Austin, so this would have been like 92, 93. I was in my mid-20s. And he introduced me to Billie Holiday, and he also introduced me to being at least a little bit more open to Valentine's Day by giving me two Billie Holiday CDs. But I don't think that's really answering your question. That's more talking about the poem. But
you know, maybe reading the poem might open up some things. So
yeah,
why don't you cue that up? I'm going to close the window because the boat noise is
out of control.
Is a little bit. Well, it's a Sunday. It's a sunny day.
Yeah.
So let me just close it. I don't think it's too warm either. So. And one more. All right. That's better.
But I mean, before I read the poem, because I don't want to forget this thread, like I do think that music and poetry are a way to access memory, and they're also a way to grab memory in a different way than you can just do with language. Mm-hmm. Because there's those gaps you were talking about earlier. There's those gaps in music where, you know, your imagination can, like, bridge. And I do want my work to, like, reach to a reader and have them have to make meaning for that relationship, so that there's something happening between us. I never want my poem to just be like language for language's sake. I might be very caught up in the language and really be focused on, you know, making the language very particular, but it's because I'm trying to get a spirit of some moment or thing. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I'll read this and then we'll see where we go from there. My Funny Valentine. Without thought of that music, derives its haunting power more by memory than being, by its homogeneity. In other words, you're here, so might you wake this year's red holiday too. I cover the waterfront, I'm watching you. A song haunt, certainly its own memorable place. Balloons resist potencies as container. You can't hate Valentine's Day, exerts an active influence on us. Chet Baker, Billie Holiday, and these words have no idea who you are.
Right. Good to have the background mm-hmm. on that. That adds, it's helpful
mm-hmm.
with this irritable reaching. that we all, well, I do, certainly, more than my fair share.
Well, I feel like this book is a different book for me. And I mean that in so many ways. I don't even know where to begin when I had to say that out loud. But I would not call it autobiographical, but I would call it more deeply personal than any other book that I've written. And it's really, I've done so much work from the time that I took a workshop in Seattle at the Extension Program, when it was still called the Extension Program.
At UW.
Yes, at UW.
With whom?
It was Yana Harris.
No kidding.
And April Donato was in my class.
No kidding.
As was another poet that I don't remember her name because she was awful to me. But in any case, that scratched that off the record. But in any case, in that, there were people that were extremely frustrated with my work. And now I understand why, because it was highly internal.
Uh-huh.
And it was young and internal, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I worked very hard subsequently to make the concrete ground of my poetry as accessible as possible so that I could weave the abstraction in there and it would still create the world or the spirit that I wanted to create with that particular piece or that body of work.
Yeah.
If that, yeah.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And especially, an institution like the UW, which is rather conservative in its aesthetic, you know?
Yes.
UW Bothell, certainly more open, but, their own sorts of, methods and challenges and preferences. Yeah, but definitely more open, it seems to me.
April Donato in that class was, that is the reason that class, I really gained, most of what I gained was through meeting her and getting to work with her. She's a wonderful poet.
Another New Yorker. That's right. Fantastic. She used to hang out at Red Sky Poetry Theater.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember seeing you at Red Sky, but that was about the time.
No, I think that it wasn't very long after that that I started working at Microsoft, and that was pretty consuming. And then 9/11 happened, and then I was applying for grad school, and then in 2002 I was starting my master's.
But we've entered a sidebar. But the thing that you were talking about is it's a very different book.
It's a very different book for me, and I think it's likely my most difficult book for a reader. I would think. I mean, I have no idea. I haven't talked to people about it, but I would guess that it is.
I feel better with your saying that. Because, doing the interviews for me is a way to, gain more intimacy with someone's work, someone who I find is valuable, which is great that I'm no longer in radio, because radio would say, well, why don't you do, somebody who studies with David Wagner or something like that. And I'm not interested in that kind of, linear narrative, as you put it earlier. But I also, as I said in my introduction, it's deep and it rewards repeated readings. And that's what art's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Even The Simpsons has that. You'll notice things you didn't notice the first one or two times you watched it. So good art is something that you should not only be able to go back to and get more out of, but read 5 or 10 years later after you've changed and more, hopefully become more wise, and you get more out of it. It's a different person reading the book.
Right.
And it has more to say to you at that point. So. Fascinating.
I also think, it's really interesting to hear you talk about it. I mean, I think that in addition, you made me think of something else, that this is really the, I feel like, part of either a 2 or 3 part whole.
Yeah.
Like what is now coming, what I'm working on now is definitely going, I mean, it's related to this so much that in that margin shift reading, even I was mixing pieces, the newer pieces, because they're just so intertwined with this book.
Keep branching off from, graftings off.
Yeah, and I mean, I can talk about that too, but that's a whole other question.
Would you call it a serial poem?
Well, I am sort of a, I do sort of write that way.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean to you?
Well, I don't see this as a serial book. I don't see this as a serial, but I know that serial poetry has been like attractive to me. I mean, Elements, if we think about Elements, and I have The Last Will Be Stone too, which is all about art pieces about death. And so it's really a reflection on death and art. I would not call it, what's that word where you're like ekphrastic? I wouldn't call it an ekphrastic book because that's not what it's really trying to do. But I do see that as serial work. I mean, I systematically went through art pieces and, you know, sort of explored them in this serial fashion. And so I guess I'm implicitly defining what I mean by serial is when you have like a lot of a type and you have a lot of elements of that type and you are hitting those in some way that makes a meaningful whole.
Right. And you're not just writing occasional poems that when you get 30 or 60 of them, you put them in a book and it's a book.
Right, right. Right.
You're writing a book from the beginning.
Yes, right. Yes. And I'm almost, I mean, I can't think of an example where I don't have a strong conceptual drive for every single book. This was memory. Elaine was labor and what East-West relations and women, you know, women and labor, women in history, I guess. Elements was obviously the periodic table about science. Keep is about memory. I mean, I get fixated on something and I'm like a dog on a pants leg and mm-hmm, I just mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The book's in four sections.
Mm-hmm.
Five, if you count the one poem in the section Keep.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the importance of chapters in this book and if you had them before you started or they evolved as you began to assemble the book.
Okay.
He doesn't know how to go out forward. He's just learning how to pilot that boat. So he's, on previous occasions, backed out all the way into the lake.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's interesting. And flying the Pan-African flag today, which is interesting. I've never seen that flag.
Maybe he'll get nicer as he gets more confident with his boat.
You know, there's always the hope. He might be figuring it out now. I think
he's turning it around. She's probably like instructing him, like,
yeah, how close he is, and I think he's making it. Look at that.
Yay.
Yeah.
I have a feeling this might be the turning point for him for Miss Pretty or Purdy, whatever it's called.
Yeah, Miss Purdy. Yeah, Miss Pearly. That's what it is.
Miss Pearly.
Yeah.
So the sections.
They're all occasions for practice, aren't they? You have we talked about a difficult time with this man with his loud boat and his, you know, he had a dog in a car one time and it was a hot day and the dog sounded like someone was beating it. And I tried to, you know, it's not a pleasant sound.
Oh.
And, you know, you want to call the cops. No one was beating the dog, but it sounded like it was in serious distress and, you know, it was going on. And it, of course, affects our afternoon. But anyway, he's making it out. You thought of something as I was talking about occasions for practice.
Yeah. So the sections happened as I was writing the book. They just sort of organically happened. And that was because I had the setup, the lens I was building, and I ended up calling it cartography because this ended up being such a place-focused mm-hmm. book. Of course it did, because I moved all over creation growing up, and my memory is moving all over the place. That's
and Dogen says, when you find the place where you are, practice begins.
Right,
right,
right, right, exactly. And then, you know, this section, while I was writing, I was like, okay, there's going to be this section that's the scattered thunderstorms, and then they became, like, city-specific or place-specific. And then dreams... that I wanted to do some dream work because I've never done a conscious effort inside one of my published books of dream work. And I wanted to do something. And I had so many dreams that were just clearly so important. I mean, like the dreams that you remember for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The one about the sister's boyfriend is a dream I had when I was like 23 or 21. And then Prowns was, if there was anyone that was kind of like was not expected, it was that one. Because what happened is that I was probably, you know, this far through this book, you know, like this body of poems, the first three sections. And then I saw the Elisitsky piece at, I think it was one of the Harvard museums. And it's in the notes in the book. And I ended up wanting to I wanted to have poems that did spatially what he does. And so I was trying to do something different spatially on the page with these poems at the same time that I was meditating on place and memory. And because of the spatial orientation, and here Edward Casey is here again, but what was interesting is that, and after this book, I will be designing my own books in InDesign from here on out, because I lost a lot of my line length with this book. Mm-hmm. These were very long lines, mm-hmm. and I had to end up breaking them in not ideal places, but I just did the best I could with the format that I had. Mm-hmm. That is nothing about the publisher, Doozy. She did an astonishingly great job with this book. It just, we ended up not being able to format it in the line lengths that I had envisioned. And so I'm mentioning it right now because it's spatially not exactly as it was on my 8.5 by 11 Word document. Right. Yeah. Not to get too in the weeds, but.
But it's all an occasion for practice.
Right.
And when I said that, you immediately picked up the book as if, wait, I got a poem for you. Was that the case, or was I?
No, I was just like, oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. But since you mentioned the sister's boyfriend dream, maybe that's a good thing.
Okay.
And this is from the chapter.
This is from Signs.
Signs. It's the first poem.
Yeah, it's the first poem in Signs.
And I've got notes on this. I've underlined the last line, which is in quotes, and then I wrote creepy dream.
Yeah, it was a creepy dream. Yeah. This does not do it justice, frankly. This poem, because it was a crazy dream. Okay. You're the sister's boyfriend. You're the sister. In a bedroom, bare save the heart-shaped bed, red satin spread shaped also like a heart. Someone from behind you jabs syringe into thigh, jester figure appears, podium legs rivet to base in brightly colored clothing. Half theater, half clown, pointed hat flickers a checkered black and white. The jester faces the scene. In the bed, you are the boyfriend who leans in to kiss the drugged girl. Morning, you are the girl who enters the kitchen to find scattered on all kitchen surfaces small scraps of paper with the word personal, and the brother who speaks to her. Everything is personal. I don't know why I added the to her, but...
Do you use any dream books to break down and... Here's my irritable reaching again. To provide some meaning. When you have a dream like that, it's like, what the fuck just happened? What's this about?
Yeah. Well, I think I've been trying to figure out since I had it. Uh-huh. So,
are you a gestaltist? Do you believe that every aspect of the dream is an aspect of yourself?
No, not always. And I also don't look at those dream books because I don't believe that everyone's iconography or symbology is the same. Mm-hmm. I think that we're all very different. And Carl, my husband, he tends to think that dreams are just kind of like processing, and it's just kind of, you know, emotional garbage being processed. I think for myself, there's much more of a tangible fabric happening there. And it is related to... I mean, I can see my upbringing all over this poem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just look at it, and I mean, even just the last line.
And your personal mythology?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Probably. Yeah. I mean, the gender, the switching, I mean, I'm switching from girl to boy, that anti-binary sentiment that I expressed earlier. So yeah, there's a lot in this dream that, is very much me. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah. Prune? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Because if you say it prune, it sounds like a dried plum. So.
Yes, yes, that's true, which is probably how it's pronounced in El Lisitsky's world, but...
P-R-O-U-N, so prune. Like noun with a PR from, like pronoun without the N, or whatever, how you were saying. Proud is a concept that comes out of El Lisitsky. It always comes down to the Russians, these days.
Oh, it was the Arthur M. Sackler Museum at Harvard.
Okay, so you're in this museum, and this Russian artist's paintings are on the wall? And
where, so I believe that in on the wall... in the placard next to the piece, they told us that the viewer wants to find Prown as the station where one changes from painting to architecture, and that was the seed. That was like, oh, how cool! Because I love translating, like I love translating stuff into other mediums. I love doing lo-fi video. I love doing photography. I love doing video. Did I already say video? I love making books. All of these things, like translating from one medium to another, is very fascinating to me, and I really like to see what happens. Mm-hmm. It's probably, again, the gaps and what gets created and what new gaps happen, what is filled in, what is able to be filled in by a spatial piece that language can't do on the page. And so I kind of got very excited about that, and I was like, well, I'm going to do, you know, this translating of my language into a more spatial way, just into a more spatial
construct.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. And see what happens. Mm-hmm. And this is what happened.
I think we need to hear some of it.
So okay,
what would you, I mean,
I do have favorites.
Good, do that.
Let me see. I'll just read the last poem in the book. Also a prune. One. You seek a mobile home in him, yet space rises before you. You linger in the rift. A patriarch pulls down the druk bed. House with rock wall beside the lake distracts the beads. You look through glass and see nothing shorter. Boundaries contrast what in the ruin? Thin, delicate lines, near enough to act as string. House, the song, dissonance mitigated, certain things kept away. You don't have to bridge the distance. What falls from the hands? Two. Chord and boundary might be said to complement one another. Then there, Alaska. The girl, regressed, stands on bow, silences the glacier. Three. Hurricane remainders blow down makeshift beds. Cats manifest a disheveled electric. Tarps, plastic bags, branches, separated but free. You understand the contradiction by watching wind whip across the land, then turn your back to the window. It's a pretty sassy poem. I'm glad that you laugh like that, because I think that you kind of understand that.
You know, I don't know that I understand it, but I do know that I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I do know that I go to poetry not to get the instant gratification. In fact, Sam Hamill said,
"Oh, Sam.
Instant gratification is the enemy." And I think about him. When I think about that, you know, that the people in the poetry community who want that instant gratification are really the ones that I don't find myself drawn to.
Right.
So I look at a book like yours, and I do feel that it's kind of a struggle. But I also remember that all the poets that I love deeply, it was a struggle. They weren't going to say, here, you can get it on the first serving, you know? Mm-hmm. You're going to get it on the seventh or eighth. And once you get it, how my mind works, then it becomes easier. Because I envision this sort of like trap door. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, I'm falling into it now. And it's worth it. To me, that's worth it.
Right.
Is this, what is the connection between this Brown and the work of art that you saw? Semi-ekphrastic? Do you vamp from the piece?
Oh.
How would you describe it?
Mm.
Because were we to see the piece, would we have more of a sense of where, no, you're shaking your head.
No. I think that the El Lissitzky, I think that his piece was a seed.
Catalyst.
It was a catalyst. It was a catalyst. I liked the way this art piece was done, and I liked the way it was trying to translate something from some field to another field, or some construct to another construct. And I want to try to do that and see what happens. And then what happened was what I did. And I don't think there would be, I mean, if you stood there and went like this, I mean, I'm sure some brilliant human, Michael Ruby, could probably, like, if I handed Michael Ruby this poem, and he probably has it in his brain, frankly. But anyway, I think he could probably do it, but I don't think just anyone could make the connection. Mm. It would have to be somebody pretty, what is the word I'm looking for?
Astute? Psychic?
But Michael has books, of course, that are devoted to memory, like his own books. And so I felt like he had a really interesting insight into this particular manuscript. But erudite is what I was actually thinking of.
What did you hope to discover when you set about to write and keep? Or what did you discover in the act of writing it?
I think what I set out to discover was an understanding of how I feel like brain science and Buddhism fit together. As I mentioned, even, you know, in graduate school, I was thinking about the evocations that I found again and again in literary theory of Buddhist thought. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to explore that. That was very important. I also was really intrigued by, I was truly intrigued by my inability to, my way of remembering. Like, and what that meant. And now, I mean, I do have a deeper understanding of that now, but I'll leave that for the other part of the question. Mm-hmm. So I was very keenly interested in how my memory works and why it worked that way. Mm-hmm. And trying to just get inside of these fragments of memory to see what happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm the kind of writer, this is why I'm not a narrative poet, I don't start with the answer and then write about, you know, write about the answer. I start with a question, and I start with a question, I throw it out there, and then I, you know, pull back and I figure out what I'm, and then I find my answer. That is how I come to the page. And it's also, you know, for better or for worse sometimes, that's the way I think. Mm-hmm. I kind of talk things out and whatnot. I feel like what I got from the book was the knowledge that, yes, there are different kinds of memory, but there are some things that that I'm navigating in terms of my history that probably have something to do with the way that I remember. And that was very insightful and undoubtedly led to what I'm writing, what I'm working on now. Mm-hmm. So,
are you able to be more gentle on your old self because of writing the book and seeing the way memory works and the way memory is constructed?
Yes. Yeah. And but that is also a work in progress.
As it is for all of us.
Yes.
I think it's fascinating. This book and your work to me is just fascinating. And your performance at Margin Shift was incredibly memorable.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
I'm grateful that we had this time to talk about it. And
yeah, me too.
Continued success.
Thank you.